Hello, and thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, the podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. My name is Adam Jeziorski, and as always, I'm here with my good friend, Josh Steenpun.
How's it going?
Not too bad.
And that was a new introduction, Adam. It was different than normal.
I made some notes. I tried preparing.
I was surprised, because when you went off script, I thought, oh, we're going to have to retake this. And no, it was good. Different, though. Perfect. I've never been introduced on the show before. That's great. I feel like I'm the guest today. When in fact, I am not today. However, we are going to talk about an interesting topic and a summation, a close on our contagious ideas arc that we've been working on now. This will be the sixth and final episode on that. And we're just going to sum up a little bit about science in the COVID period in this pandemic era.
Science in a dangerous time, if you will.
Science in a dangerous time, yeah.
Yes. 2020 is only, well, I guess it's more than halfway through now.
Thank God.
It's been weird.
It has been weird, yeah. It's an interesting one, too, because this is the year we started the podcast. Did we record one in 2019, or we started all of our recordings in 2020, early in January?
Yeah, no, I think we did the first release towards the end of January, and it was like probably after New Year's, like in the depths of winter, but definitely.
Right, yeah. So the Core Ideas podcast has never known a year but 2020. So from that perspective, it has only ever existed primarily under this very strange, strange time period that we find ourselves in, and will continue to find ourselves in probably after 2020 has ended, to be realistic with ourselves. So that means, like, I've seen you, because we record these and we like talk more than we have in a while leading up to doing this, which has been really nice. But from other perspectives, it's been very strange. And included in that is in a scientific perspective.
Yeah, no, definitely. I did not think at the beginning of 2020 that, you know, the calls that we do to record these podcasts and seeing you on the screen, like, you'd be one of the human beings I see most.
Yeah.
Through this year. That is not, like, you know, my immediate family.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's, I guess that's the nature of some of these unexpected things, is they can throw wrenches completely into the best plans. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about a little bit as we go through this sort of summary and wrap up of some of the things associated with it.
Yeah. And so, obviously, a lot has happened. Global pandemic, massive lockdowns, field seasons scrambled, ends of semesters canceled, lots of video conferencing, video teaching.
Everyone's a professional at using Zoom and getting their microphone just so, and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a lot of knock-on effects of what has gone over in like the last 5 months already, but in many ways it's going to continue on through the rest of this year. Like, I'm not sure how many universities are going to be back to normal in the fall, but definitely none of the ones in Ontario. I don't think any of the ones in Canada anywhere or any kind of normal schedule.
Yeah, I don't know for sure that, but not completely back to normal for sure. There'll be differences even if they are on campus.
So, you know, even as we gradually come out of, you know, all this weirdness, it's going to be a long time before we're fully back to normal. And given, you know, our interest in paleontology, talk about more general terms. But one thing that I'm very curious to see is, will there actually be an impact in the paleo record that will be noticeable from everything shutting down, like, at the level that it did for the amount of this time? Like, it seems like there'd be no way that, in things like the CO2 record, there's going to be some sort of blip that would be measurable for sure. But will that carry through into the actual sediments? Like, time will tell.
Yeah.
But
and I think you're right. If you look closely enough and you find the right archive, whatever that might be, ice records or lake sediments or tree rings or whatever it is, somewhere you will be able to find that record. But will it be something broad enough, especially for such a short duration, that you can find it more ubiquitously around different environments? Will it be the equivalent of the Chernobyl peak that we find only in certain areas because other areas were impacted more so? Yeah, and that's something that time will tell, and how long will it be before we can make that determination?
Yeah, when we start seeing 2020 barbs, will those be?
Yeah.
What sort of weird characteristics will they have due to what, instead of what has happened, like largely what has not happened?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Whether it's because there's not as many planes flying or any of the other sort of impacts, what will that look like? Will it be noticeable? And how long-lived will it be? And there's no question, I'm sure, in most people's mind who are thinking about the broader climatic impacts. We're not saying this is going to result in a reversion of the anthropogenic climate change. This will be a minor blip in the ever-increasing CO2 concentration or whatever metric you want to use to describe the impact, but it will be there and it will be noticeable and it will be something to talk about and to discuss.
Yeah, absolutely. But we don't know, and we won't know for a while. But what we do know is that there have definitely been impacts on research in general. Again, everything locked down. Thank you to everyone that answered our Twitter poll asking about field seasons, and and we got 100% response rate of field seasons completely canceled. And
So for those who didn't see it, the question was, has COVID-19, has the pandemic resulted in a change in your plans for field sampling in particular, not any of your other plans? And yes, completely canceled. Yes, but we've modified it in some manner, or no, business as usual.
And basically everyone said it had been completely canceled. And, you know, outside of our devoted listenership, you know, just asking around the people that we know and interact with, that seems to be, you know, the general consensus. And that extends beyond, you know, academics. There's going to be serious impacts on data collection and long-term monitoring records. So my main long-term record, I don't know what you call it, organization that I have any interactions with myself would be through the Ontario Ministry of the Environment and the Dorset Environmental Science Centre. And I'm not sure exactly what the status is. I've not talked to anyone there in a month and a half or so. But back then, I don't think they were yet committed to the whole everything being a complete write-off, but that was definitely looming. So I'm not sure if there's been some means of adjusting so not everything is lost. But it's definitely, no matter what, it's going to be an anomaly in the databases going forward.
And they also run the Lake Partner Program, which more broadly, where they oversee the Lake Partner Program in that from that location. The Lake Partner Program in Ontario is this way of getting communities and citizen science and other people to collect data, and all of the information is channeled through the MOE, CC, or whatever they're called now. As far as I know, much of that, if not all of that, is completely shut down. So there's a really broad implications for
people working from data. Home, there's no way to deal with like hundreds and hundreds of samples being sent in, or even to get the hundreds and hundreds of sample kits sent out to the people in the first place.
Let alone analyzed after the fact when, you know, there's no lab or the labs are running at skeletal capacity, if they're running at all. And that moves well beyond any one region or any one organization or institution. Like, that is if there is a scientific legacy of COVID at a broad scale, I think that may be it, is that there's this lack of data for many locations where physical sampling by humans is required. Now, if you have temperature loggers out, or you have rain gauges or those kind of things, those devices are still going to be collecting data. And so long as they don't need to be repaired, the data should exist. But where people need to go and sample them, that's going to be a real gap in the record moving forward. So that will never be replaced.
Yeah, like zooplankton hauls, you know, water samples.
Even Secchi disc depths, you know, all of those things.
Yeah. And going from there, so, you know, and so, yeah, so our focus, my only direct interaction so far in terms of these data sets has been with the dorsal mom, but I imagine it extends to most, if not all. Although it would be curious to see if this is, you know, in some of the states in the U.S. where the shutdown didn't really happen or happen on a much lower level, that they didn't, you know, this will not actually be a blip in some records.
Or in locations where there may be, you know, it's easier to collect these samples and still keep physical distancing. I'm not sure if ELA is conducting some, I'm pretty sure from...
There's some stuff going on because their Twitter is active.
There is some sampling going on, at least in order to keep the experiments going that require these data and some bare minimum amount of monitoring, or they may be doing all of theirs for all I know. So data will exist. It's not that everywhere has been completely shut down, but there will be a gap in some records, which have not had many gaps in a long, long time. I don't know how many gaps there are in the Dorset A Lake set, but there's not many. It's a pretty complete record. And to have a year obliterated is a big thing.
Yeah. And then going from there in terms of, so we're talking in those long-term data collections, largely about, public entities. I think another one going forward will be the impacts on legislation in terms of environmental monitoring going forward. You were mentioning monitoring of the Athabasca River and some of the things that have been changing.
These don't seem to be generally good stories in this case. Not that the lack of data is a good story, but these seem to be at least the ones that I've seen. Examples of governments using the pandemic as a way of slipping in other legislation or removing environmental regulation as a way of cutting some of the red tape, in air quotations, that they often like to talk about, whether it's removing the requirements for such rigorous impact assessments, which is something that is happening in the States, or in Alberta, the push to decrease where monitoring is occurring downstream in the oil sands region on the main branch of the Athabasca River. Those are all changes that, yes, there may be impacts associated with the ability to carry out these kind of work, but removing them entirely under the guise of squeezing them in sort of in an omnibus sort of fashion is taking advantage of a situation. And the question really becomes, if it is because of a very temporary perspective, when do we get those back? And how quickly can those be reinstated if they absolutely must be removed? And I wait to see that one.
Once again, time will tell. And it's added to the list of knock-on effects of the last 6 months or so.
Yeah, or things that may be pushed back against, and with the right amount of pressure, they may realize that, you know, there's pretty smart people who work for these environmental regulation agencies and do the monitoring. They can figure out how to do that if we make it a continued priority that it needs to be.
Yeah, and continuing with our 40,000 foot kind of view of the impacts on.
I haven't been in a plane. And this is, speaking of impacts, this is the longest I haven't been in an airplane in years, many years. So I haven't been to 40,000 feet in a long time.
Yeah, me either. But I was going to say, in terms of like impacts on research, on the paleo record, on environmental legislation, and there's also been impacts on this podcast. Like, I mean, this whole arc
big time.
Has been a scrambly curveball, because we thought that through the summer we'd be able to coast on, you know, some interviews and whatnot that we were able to squeeze out of the PALS conference that never happened in May.
Yeah. Yeah. You might have got to hear someone beyond Adam and I and Jenny, who we made come on because she lives here with me. Yeah, we would have, might have had some different voices. We had some informal discussions about lining up some guest voices that just never happened. So what are you going to talk about? Well, let's talk about contagious ideas and fill in some episodes. So we put those ideas in. They're not removed. We haven't removed them. We've just moved them to the back of the list.
Yeah. But yeah, there's always next year.
There is always next year.
We hope. But reining it from the general to something more specific, like talking about, I think we can go forward talking about the impacts of this in a more direct level. And I think, you know, one group that we interact with on a, you know, very regular level would be students. And, you know, students coming in at the undergraduate level, at the graduate level, current students, all these are being massively affected by, you know, the impacts on teaching, the impacts on
just working conditions,
thesis progress, research. Yeah. Yeah, I think we can talk for a little while about that. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of questions being raised, just in our own labs, you know, international students, potentially not coming. So that's members of our labs not showing up, in September, even though there's not really much to show up to. Showing up
is, again, in air quotes, but not being able to join the lab in whatever capacity. Yep.
That's major applications. We were riffing on this a little bit before we actually started recording, but I know, like, undergraduate me would have totally taken a gap year at this point. Like, I was, you know, did some major, switched my majors while I was an undergrad, and this kind of happened while I was kind of like questioning exactly what I was most interested in. I would just been, you know what? Pause, and I will figure something out and maybe do some online courses. But in terms of my interest in biology and chemistry, I know I would have gone, I don't want to miss the labs.
Well, it's a reasonable response. And many will do the same thing, for sure.
And we'll see how many that will have. Like, Queen's campus is going to be, you know, at like 25% of its usual capacity come September, with most stuff.
And that's a small campus. Yep. So, you know, there's not 50,000 people crawling around on a given day.
Nope. But, you know, it's going to be incredibly noticeable.
Yeah. That would put it kind of into maybe what it looks like in the summer, in terms of the summer students on campus, which is pretty small, having stayed there a number of times and been a grad student there. It was always great to, you know, not have to stand in line at the Tim Hortons because there was so few people on campus. Might not be the same vibe now, but
well, it'd even be open. 6 foot apart. No idea.
Yeah, I don't know. And at York, I mean, we only have a little bit of anecdotal evidence. So far as I know, the number of people entering in from right out of high school has not changed significantly. So there will be a lot of new students, even if they're not physically on campus, and how to deal with residences and that kind of thing. The first year experience is a huge issue. We were asked to put together, you know, kind of welcome videos for the students coming into the first year, because I teach a first year course, in order to kind of give them that, you know, that little bit of university spirit and that sort of thing.
Actually, that's something.
But how to do orientation is hard.
Yeah, I'd not really thought of that. Because it doesn't directly impact me, but yeah, the coming in to do remote courses or online courses is one thing, but yeah, if you come in or you don't come in, that camaraderie with the people in your classes and your program, like that first, you know, week or two, has such an impact on the following 4 years. And
how do you have an online frosh week?
Yeah.
Like, no idea. There are people who are working really hard to try and make it, as you know, the best of a terrible situation, but it will be very different, no doubt. I can't even imagine what the university experience wouldn't have, how different it would have been. Even people who are like at Queens, where I did my undergrad, the number of students on campus is a significant number. Unlike, for example, York, where we have a lot of commuting students, most students at Queens are on campus in first year. So you have this, you know, unicohesiveness, everyone's staying in the same area, everyone's all together. There's kind of that, I don't want to say indoctrination, but there's a real development of an esprit de corps. And the students who stay outside of, who live at home, the first years not in residence, have a very different experience. Like they come in and do all those same sort of activities, but it is different. To take that, even that part away would be what will be very different.
Yeah, I was going to say, not would be, will be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so it's interesting that you said that you're not seeing that much of a difference in terms of the application straight out of high school. Because one of my gut feelings is this going to be the creation of a second double cohort?
I think you're right, though. And I would say that just because they have applied to programs doesn't mean they're going to take a full course load. It's quite common. I would suspect, because doing everything online is harder, that students may take a decreased course load in order to only do a couple of courses. So they're registered in the program, they'll get through a few of them, and then maybe take a fifth year to finish that out. And that will, you're absolutely right.
And just for reference, depending on how young our audience is, the double cohort was a thing that happened, that I'm sure has happened other places too, specifically referring to in Ontario when they...
The entering class of 2003, who finished high school in 2003.
Yeah. Who basically... It wasn't grade 13, but the fifth year of high school that you could do, it was OAC at the time, was canceled. So you applied to university straight out of grade 12. And when that was canceled, then you had 2 years worth of students applying to university at the same time. The people who did the last year of OACs and the first year of students that applied straight from grade 12. And it was a big thing at the time in terms of accommodating that, double load into the universities. And I think you have some personal experience with that.
I was at the grade 12 entrance group. So I had no option to do an OAC or a grade 13 year. And it really depended on the institution. So some schools didn't really change the number of program slots. So it became a little bit more competitive. Others opened up really broadly. A lot of them were limited by how many residence beds there would be. So Queens didn't really expand their programs, and not because they couldn't have more biology majors. It was more because if 80% of the students who are admitted come to campus, there's just not enough beds for all of them to stay. So yeah, it definitely changed the whole kind of energy around the applying to university and getting into different programs. And some programs maybe were a little bit more challenging to gain access to.
Again, time will tell if maybe not to the same extent that happens, but if there is that kind of same change in terms of some programs becoming more competitive due to people sitting on the sidelines for a year.
Yeah, I think that's very possible.
And then there's a whole suite of potential impacts directly from that. So not just acceptance potentially becoming more competitive down the line, but then there'll be knock-on effects for years in terms of scholarships and grants if you're dealing with, you know, more people applying for the same things.
Yep. So yeah, the financial impacts of this are obviously massive at every level. And they're not all things that have been felt or are being felt right now. There will be future financial implications, including how to support students who are now going to come to the university. And through scholarships, you know, they come from all different sources. Some of them come from the university themselves, and all that money is invested into, you know, ways to grow those funds. So universities have taken a hit on their financial portfolio, just the same as every other financial portfolio out there.
So that is really, you know, again, a whole pile of questions being raised for new students or students just starting, whether it be at the undergraduate or graduate level. There's a whole bunch of questions, you know, being raised as well for the current students at the graduate level. We've got a whole suite of students that are doing their defenses through a Zoom meeting. We have people missing a field season, you know, and in a PhD or a master's, we only have, you know, one to three field seasons to work with. That is significant.
Huge, yeah.
And, you know, if you have no data, how do you construct a thesis?
Yeah, there'll be many people who are digging through the sediment core archives in their respective labs, perhaps pulling out old records that might be usable for different kinds of analyses that it may not have been their first intention, but that'll be a start. They may not use that for their entire project, but that'd be a good way to get started and not waste not only the whole summer that has been missed for sampling, but then the entire year of analyzing those samples until you can go back to get the next set. So you're losing not just a window in the field, but all of the analyses you can do trying to work with shared data. So we talked about open data and the ability to perhaps access some of those repositories and work with publicly available or shared information in order to incorporate that into a thesis. There are ways to work around that, obviously, but they'll be very project-specific, very lab-specific, and just another thing to have to think about in all of this while you're trying to, you know, make sure all your family are well and all those kind of things that are already weighing on the mind. So there's a huge amount of extra energy that is required to deal with some of those situations. And they're real challenges.
Well, big time. And now we're having a fair number of, like, even my, you know, my position within the lab where I make no real major decisions about anyone's future. I'm just, you know, more in the role of a training / mentor role for people coming in. It's like, you can't, you know, no one coming in right now, I can't sit beside them and check their chronometry trays and point out like training is ground to a halt. And
yeah. And in Jenny's lab here, you know, the students who, a couple of them have microscopes that they've taken home. I think you have a microscope.
Yeah, I've got a little at home microscope dungeon set up in the basement that I've been confined to.
So the students who are just learning in some cases, they would keep aside those coronometry trays and then they would transfer them off to one of the postdocs who could then look over them or do things like that. Like they're working through those scenarios, but it's just so much more effort for everyone involved. It adds time, it adds effort, it adds logistical nightmares associated with all of it. You got to make do, but it really does add a terrible amount of strain.
My goodness. Yeah. No, I can't imagine the transporting of chronometries is practical.
Or pour them back into something. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not sure what they're doing.
Practical or fun.
And some of the students are back in the lab. So we do have students socially or physically distanced in the labs doing required work, but they had to go through a huge, well, I didn't do any of it. Jenny did all of it for her grad students, coming up with these plans of how they would be. They have to log when they're in and out of the building. They have key card access, all of those things, just a huge amount, of red tape, necessary red tape, but red tape nonetheless.
Man, we need some omnibus bills. Cut that stuff.
We do need, yeah. That's not how our university works. And then we were talking about this, like Adam mentioned a minute ago, the Zoom defense, which has become really, really common. I've done a few of them. And that's fine. Like as a platform, it works. It gets the job done. You can share your screen. You can answer questions. It's not that different. But what happens when you're done? The best part of defending your degree is then having all of your cohort, your colleagues, lab mates, whatever.
Friends.
Around to friends. Yeah. To friends? With those.
We had very different experiences, apparently.
Yeah. Wait, you were one of my cohort. To celebrate with, you know, to toast in whatever way the huge amount of work that you went through, including surviving through a pandemic and finishing this thesis. Consequential, but very sad one in my mind. That's a big one.
Oh yeah. And I think, just on a, you know, my personal level of, both my master's and, PhD defense where you're done and you're told to leave the room and you know, they deliberate inside. Now you get shuttled inside. Into
a breakout room.
And they deliberate.
A breakout room of one. You're just on your own, just looking like, at this blank screen.
Yeah, Zoom. Feel bad for those guys. So on the one hand, it was nerve-wracking, but like looking back, you know, those are very memorable moments. Like I'm done, it's out of my hands, I feel pretty good, like it's happening. And you reflect for a little bit a second, and just like the difference, you know, people must be having today in that experience where it's just like, yeah, de-zoomed. I don't know what the, you know, whatever the terminology is.
Yep. Put back into the main room.
Yep. Screen not shared.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's
the little things like that the handshake or the high five or whatever it might be, like, yep, you did it. You
got on the back.
Doctor or whatever. Yeah. I don't really remember the order. It was one of those things that goes by really fast, but I remember it feeling pretty good.
Yeah. But yeah, no, and there's lots and lots of delayed celebrations, I'm sure.
Yeah, and that's the idea, right? Everyone just has to stay safe, and those kind of things can wait, and that's why they have to. For, you know, the people who that the consequences are much more significant.
And then
Maybe the last thing, we've talked a lot about students, and I would say that there obviously are impacts on the faculty and people who are teaching and the postdocs and all of those different things. In the grand scheme of things, I think the impact on the students is much higher just because it occupies such a large proportion of the time that they're in their degree. Faculty members, yes, it's going to impact the finances of the lab and their teaching and their research progress and all of those things.
Milestones and all, but...
Yeah, and any place, you know, if you're up for tenure or you're working, you're pre-tenure, that's a huge, really important time period. And a lot of schools have stopped the tenure clock for people for a year in order to accommodate that decrease in output and all those different, you know, the difficulty of challenge of switching to an online teaching environment, those kind of things. Those are significant. I'm not downgrading the consequences of that, but as a proportion, it's going to be a small part of your whole career.
It's not half of it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not half of your master's or a quarter of your PhD so far. But it is a huge amount of work. Like if you have a 5-year NSERC strategic grant or any grant that has a temporal duration, well, they all have time durations, I assume. I don't know of anyone who just has an unlimited amount of funding. Losing that productivity is a huge problem.
See, I thought you were going to a different way there. Because when you said if you have a 5-year, my mind filled in 5-year-old at home.
Oh, no. that's in the next one. Yeah. And that is a big part of the, people at all sorts of their career education stages have children at home, and trying to do anything at home can be really challenging. Some people have a real hard time working at home. Just because they need the change of pace, they need the change of scenery, working, and they may not have good internet, they may not have a place to work. Sitting at your kitchen table works great for trying to, you know, read a draft of a paper on a Sunday evening. But if you have to do it for months and months and months, that's a massive challenge for anyone, not just the faculty members. But then add on top of that, the cat who walks through the middle of the defense. You know, you get to see a lot of cat buttholes in Zoom meetings these days. And the kids who are just screaming in the background, or cartoons playing, or, you know, all of those different things. Those become real, real major stepping stones to being able to just do your job as you would normally, and things you don't think about. And then the job changes. So, you know, everyone has to become an expert at teaching online and making Moodle sites that are amazingly interactive because they have all these things, because you're not going to get to see the students. And, you know, I have to, like, I would consider myself a fairly tech forward professor. Like I use a fair bit of that stuff already, but for some people they do not, you know, they don't post their notes. They don't put anything on some sort of learning management system like Moodle. And it's just a massive change for people to try and not just learn how to teach online, or do anything online, but teaching is really taking up a lot of people's time these days because it's very different. But what good online teaching even looks like, because it's not the same thing as if you're teaching face-to-face. The last thing I'll say about this is that many universities offer courses that are either blended, so both online and on campus and face-to-face, or fully online education. There's lots of universities that are wholly based on that topic. But it generally takes 2 years to turn a course online.
You can't do it over March break?
No, you can't do it over March break. And it often has a team of people, and a significant amount of money can go into it because there's often a tech component to it. Whereas I'll be doing five this year.
And so this is an angle that I have no direct connection with. I don't teach any courses at all. How's it going? Have you found a groove? Are you still looking for the groove? Like at this point,
I have good days and bad days. I know exactly what I'm going to do. It's about number of hours and working more or less half time, and then working in the evenings half-time during the days because one of us is watching the little guy, and then working in the evenings. So I know what I want to do. A few days ago, I was in a pretty dark place about it. Today, I had a really good day. I got like 3 or 4 full weeks of material put online for a course. So I felt pretty good about that. And I'll get it done. I won't have the whole, like all the way through till the end of November online for all three of my fall term courses. That's not going to happen. But hopefully it'll be, you know, into October towards reading week, and that'll be good enough, and I'll do the rest as time allows moving forward. But you do have to make sacrifices. Some things just are harder, and just, you know, you can't let perfect be the enemy of good.
With it all being so front-loaded, will it actually mean like you'd be less busy than you would have been at the start of September, or nah?
I think I'll have a couple of quiet weeks. And then it probably will ramp up to, as labs for two of the courses have computer kind of based labs, they're geomatics courses, it'll get a little bit busier. My winter will be really quiet because I have my first year, I'm teaching the winter half of the first year full year course. And then my fourth year like seminar research or rivers course, which I don't really intend to like make lecture videos and stuff. They can do a lot of that stuff on their own to kind of flip the course. So I should have a very quiet winter term because I'm going to need it after the fall.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, it's interesting. Like the course that I've been most involved with in my time at Queen's is limnology, the fourth bio 335. And it's been moved to the winter, and I'm not involved with it this year, but I'm just curious what the impacts. Like there's no field weekend, and the field weekend is so,
it's ingrained. It's so you get samples for the labs are all based around the field weekend, and other people have done the same thing. Some courses can't move. Like we can't have our snow and ice course in the fall,
which I don't teach, but you gotta give a little.
Yeah. All right. So that I wouldn't say that's a Debbie Downer kind of conversation.
It's game over, man. Game over.
But it's realistic, right? Because there aren't generally a lot of really positive things that come out of a global pandemic. But there are some very minor
ones. Tell me there are some.
There are definitely some. I'll just the last couple words on that one, because we just finished on this topic in the last one. Teaching generally for a lot of faculty, especially in certain times of year, doesn't take up a huge amount of their thinking, especially when you've taught a course for a number of years. And I think this whole online process has really led to a lot of renewal in how people think about their teaching, and it probably is going to bring in some practices that they may not have incorporated before that they realize actually really work well. And they've thought a little bit more about pedagogy than they would have if they hadn't been sort of forced to reevaluate what they teach and really like distill down what is the core information they need and what's more supplementary. So that's a benefit. I've had more discussions about teaching and good teaching with people because I do a lot of teaching. So people, you know, and a lot of tech focused teaching. So it's something I've had a fair few discussions about than I've ever had.
Okay. Can I put you on the spot for a second and say, what is your biggest takeaway over like this 5 month focus on remote teaching?
A takeaway in terms of like, if I had one thing I would recommend to people or
recommend to people
what I've learned
or what you would go back and tell yourself like last January? Has there been any kind of real revelations in this period or no?
Not particularly. I don't think so. I think a lot of the online is very different than like teaching online and having just some of your material and putting it online is not the same as teaching online. And that's fine because the students are expected to come to class. You know, you can make it easy for the ones who can't come to class or choose not to, but that's not what you're trying to do. This time we're trying to teach entirely online and it's quite different. And that's key. You have to adapt. And if there was one thing I would take home is that it takes way longer to do anything online. I've taken a bunch of courses through our teaching and learning group. And being a student in even two courses at a time, which I'm doing right now, is a fair amount of saturation of just energy. Of course, I'm trying to prep all of my courses too, but you know, it's hard to just keep up with even the minor things. So yeah, respect the fact that it takes people a long time to navigate that world.
Okay. And then I guess another big silver lining, we've talked about this already and we've devoted a full episode to writing manuscripts. And I think there's, you know, maybe not 2020, but I think 2021 will probably be a, you know, banner year for publications, books, textbooks, and those kind of things in terms mm-hmm. of volume, as people, you know, cannot go into the lab and focus on clearing their backlog in some ways.
For sure. That paper I talked about in that episode, if anyone's listening who listened to it, got and minor revisions. I sent them back the other day. So I hope for accepted in the not too distant future, which was very fast. Have you been
virtual high five?
Virtual high five. Yeah. Have you been asked to do any reviews? Thinking about what we talked about the other day. I have not been asked to do a single review during the pandemic.
I have not. Me neither. Mentally, I guess I was prepared to get like a bump in that as well, but no.
Yeah. I think Jenny's had two or three, but that's not outside of the sort of normal range. So I haven't noticed a big difference, at least from our sample size of now three.
We don't have the necessary renown, I guess.
Yeah, maybe not. Or maybe those are just kind of getting out there. And there's a lot of work on the editors too. So the associate editors. And we'll be sending those out. Maybe there'll be a bump kind of going.
Yeah, I imagine they do not really view this backlog clearing as a silver lining in many ways.
I doubt that as well. Yeah. I guess there are some more kind of personal ones that are silver linings for sure. You get to spend more time at home. As I said, this is the longest time I haven't been on a plane in my adult life, probably.
Seriously?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because I hadn't been away since last field season. So like last year, to go a whole calendar year without getting on an airplane is not something I've done since I was a grad student.
See, that's really interesting because that's part of that is where, because I don't have that same perspective, but I didn't get into a plane for very many of my field seasons ever. It was all mm-hmm. Drivable. So,
absolutely. Yeah. This is the longest I've not been in the field. This is the first summer I've not gone in the field since 2007, when I was starting my master's. So.
I've slowed it down since the kiddos arrived, and I have been able to spend a lot more time with them.
Yeah, big time.
And you know, it's crazy. Like you know, so my youngest will be turning three in a couple months. So this lockdown period is like a significant portion of her entire life. Like I mean, your little guy's a year younger. Like I mean, it's like a quarter of his life at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, he's completely changed. Like he's gone from just barely talking to talking in sentences in here. You know, yeah. And sometimes the sentences he comes in like turns my chair around and says monkey video. Like he wants to watch a monkey video on YouTube instead of me getting to do this thing where he'll come and told one of Jenny's students who was on a Skype call that he loved him. He said, love you, because the only people he talks to on the computer is it's family, right? His grandparents. So one of the grad students is now family. But it's been that's been really good.
Yeah, no. So it's been good. And you know, working with the kids at home, have found new, I don't know, intellectual pursuits, dabbled in some stop motion Lego stuff
a month or so ago. If you're listening and you have not seen Adam's stop motion Lego video,
it's not mine. It's the three of us put it together.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. It's on Adam's YouTube channel, however.
No, it's not. It's on Twitter.
It oh, it's on Twitter. Oh, it's
I will link it.
In, how are we going to search it on YouTube then?
I didn't say anything about YouTube. You know what? We will retweet it from the show. Perfect. It's relevant show material now.
It is now. Yep. When this comes out, we'll retweet it. So there have been a few silver linings for sure.
And
we've got to talk about a few different interesting things in this Contagious Ideas. I think just to go back to that, how the episodes have changed, the discussions we would have had with people at PALS, which we'll still get to, would have been quite different. And this will be the end. And for those of you who maybe haven't been as, if you are listening along at the actual time and not sort of listening to them all together, that we have made a pretty big diversion away from paleolimnology in a few topics, though we've tried to tie them together. And we'll go back in the next stretch. We'll go back to some paleo-specific things. But it's been interesting to think about them.
Yeah, we've definitely widened our focus and looked into something, or talked about some things and thought about some things that I've not really thought of in as much detail in quite a while. It's been interesting. I've enjoyed it. I'm ready to get back to the bread and butter of what Core Ideas is all about.
Yeah, exactly. Talk about things that I don't have to Wikipedia almost everything we're talking about.
Oh, come on. It makes no difference. It still happens.
Yeah, it's true. And Wikipedia is great, guys. All right. Anything else? Anything else we want to wrap up here?
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, again, we're talking about silver linings in a time of great tragedy. And my heart goes out to everyone that's lost someone in this and is dealing with it. Like, we definitely have within my family some people that are high risk that we're very nervous about protecting.
And the people who didn't have that option to stay at home and work in their basement and do that sort of thing because you're standing at the till at a drugstore or any of the, you know, different
frontline
jobs that
medical workers
absolutely had to continue for society to run.
Our hardships are not so hard.
Not at all. And there we go. Next time we'll dive into a little bit of the history of paleolimnology and get back into that topic.
The history of the history of lakes.
It's going to be good. It's a multi-parter. Our first multi-part episode.
Nice. How many parts? We don't know.
We're not sure. We're just starting to work on
it. Seat of our pants all the time.
If you have any comments, questions, queries, suggestions, you can always catch us on Twitter at Core Ideas Paleo, PALEO.
Or send us emails, longform coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. All of our show notes are up on our website, Core Ideas, all one word, .ajazyorski.ca. But really, it's easy to just look up the Twitter feed and click the link from there. And the show notes all eventually make it up there. I'm usually slow, so it might be
because they take a lot of work. Because you put so much effort into them.
I think we're building a pretty cool resource and invite people to check it out.
Yeah, this will be episode 18, right? And yep. I don't think it'll be ready for Christmas 2020, but Christmas 2021, a collection of the memes is definitely going to have to be a little coffee table book we put together. So,
all right,
I love them.
Put that right beside the t-shirts.
Oh yeah, the merch. Just as part of the merch situation.
For people that are on a nice list, a year and a half from now, you watch out for that highly sought after volume.
That's right, but we'll have to ask you for your addresses, so it won't be that secret.
All right.
Great. Okay, we will catch you next time. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.
Yep. Thank you, and talk to you soon. Bye.